Blog Talk Radio.
From their studio in the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's the Boomer and the Babe Show with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Join Pete and Deborah and their guests as they give voice to 78 million baby boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Now here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
Yes, it is the Boomer and the Babe coming to you from Youngtown, Arizona in the great Northwest Valley of the Phoenix, Maricopa County area. And it is Thursday, April 5th, 2012, and we are broadcasting from those studios, the Feeding Arizona Complex in Youngtown, also home of the Valley View Community Food Bank, where the food is always free. If you ever have a hankering to make a nice donation to a 501c3, please contact and consider donating to the Valley View Community Food Bank. You can get to them via their website, valleyviewcommunityfoodbank.com. Jesse Ramirez, executive director and founder of the food bank, will be more than happy to let you know how and when you might be able to give them the assistance that they need from time to time. They're going to be moving into a new facility shortly, so I'm sure they'll be able to use some assistance there monetarily, food-wise to fill it, and also time and volunteers to help make that move. So valleyviewcommunityfoodbank.com. This is the Boomer the Babe Show, and I'm Pete Peters.
And I'm Deborah Brown.
And listen to that voice. We haven't heard that voice for a good number of weeks. She's been busy, as we say, on assignment. So I've assigned her some other things, and she said she wanted to have this assignment today because of our guest. This guest today is right in Deborah's wheelhouse. She has a lot to do and a lot to say about women's rights and so on and so forth. So our guest today, I'll introduce right away, is Gloria Feld. And she's written the new book called No Excuses, 9 Ways for Women to Take Charge, and How They Think About Power. Gloria, welcome to the Boomer the Babe Show. We're glad to have you.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be with you today.
Well, I introduced it by saying that this is in Deborah's wheelhouse also, and I wanted to make sure that she was involved in our discussions today. The nice thing about our show is we've got an hour. We can just talk about any number of things, and we can explore subjects possibly a little deeper than some of the things that you might be accustomed to doing, which is the soundbite shows and so on and so forth. So we're looking forward to this a great deal.
That's great. It's always nice when you can complete a sentence.
There you go.
You'll get to complete a sentence and a whole thought pattern and start brand new things. So what I like to do is ask for what we call your two-minute movie, and that is by way of introducing you to our listeners. And what we ask you to do is go back as far back as you'd like and tell us everything you want to tell us for 2 minutes. That's your two-minute movie.
So, that's okay. All right. Well, so I was born in a small town in Texas. I grew up in Texas in the 1940s and 50s when women were not encouraged to aspire too much. I became pregnant at 15, married my high school sweetheart. Then I woke up after 3 children and 20 years old, and the birth control pill as it came into my life. And it sort of, I can fast forward from there. The pill has been, in some respects, a defining issue in my life. And it led me ultimately into all kinds of social justice movements and ultimately to a 30-year career with Planned Parenthood, culminating as the national president. But I realized that the pill is just a metaphor, really, for women having power and agency with their in their lives. And I think, as we can see by the contraceptive coverage debate that's going on yet again in our society, that both sides really understand that. And women, who 99% of whom use birth control at some point in their lives, know that that's what gives them the ability to plan and space their childbearing and therefore the ability to determine the course of their own fate. And certainly that's how it was for me. And so now I'm writing about women, power, and leadership. I teach a course in women, power, and leadership at Arizona State University, and I speak all over the country on the topic of women, power, and leadership, and I love it.
Well, as the lone male in the room, which I find myself very often because I have a daughter two granddaughters. My mother's still alive, Deborah, and even my dog is a female.
Lucky you.
Yes. I can understand exactly what you've said, and I can see that I have to be involved in this movement in some way as a male, because I need to help to ensure that my granddaughters, who are 6 and 3 respectively, have a good future, have the options and the choices that they need to have. And I can understand exactly what you're saying. So I wanted to throw that in just for whatever it's worth. So you're amongst kindred spirits here.
Excellent. Wonderful. Well, and the truth of the matter is that, of course, it does take two to tango here. And when we say that 99% of Americans have used birth control, that means men as well as women. And
absolutely,
I think that men have got to understand what a difference birth control has made in their lives as well.
Well, it's very true. There's just so many things and so many other experiences that we may have had as a man if there hadn't been the use of contraceptive, regardless of whose responsibility or who was taking responsibility for it. It could be a very different life of an individual. And I've always said to my daughter, there are several things, and Deborah and I, as we were raising her, said there are several things that we wanted to do. Sure, we wanted to get good grades, but we wanted to be a good citizen. We wanted to be socially responsible. And we realized that there are certain things you can get yourself into that can affect your entire life, if not necessarily the final outcome, but it can certainly affect the path and the rapidity. And so, therefore, keep yourself in good stead that way. And birth control is part of it.
Well, and if I can just jump onto that for one more thing, I'm going to get myself another 30 seconds here to give you my life story.
All right. Go
which
ahead.
which is that the reason I like to talk to women and the reason I wrote No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change How We Think About Power, is that I believe that women today do have a great deal of power in our hands that we don't always recognize and we don't always use. And one of those powers is, in fact, the power to control our reproductive destiny, and that is what enables us to also have economic self-sufficiency, to be able to get an education and get a job, and to be able to be self-sufficient as a human being and to make our contributions to society. That is a power that previous generations of women simply didn't have. And because we have current generations don't know life without it, it's easy for them to devalue it. But I just want to keep delivering the message to women about the fact that we have a lot of power in our hands, but we have to know it, we have to see it, we have to own it, we have to use it. And it's not just reproductive self-determination, but that's just one of the basics. We also have a lot of economic power. We have the power of being 60% of college graduates. There are a lot of things we have in our hands. We just aren't always using them.
Well, that's a bona fide fact. I have been a member of a service club. You're probably familiar with Seroptimus International.
Yes.
And of course. And I was... during one biennium, I was in charge of the human rights status of women feature, and I was actually the chair of that for 1,600 women in one of the regions. And, you know, there's just so much out there, not only in our country but around the world, where people need to understand that status of women equals human rights, equals, you know, the good life. And if you're not paying attention to how women are treated in your society, and uplift, you know, everyone when you uplift women. I don't know. I don't understand why it gets so, frankly, discombobulated. And mm-hmm. what I mean by that is the fact that we are discussing the contraception issue at this point in our history is absolutely it's crazy. I can't even put another word on it, because in other countries where you say, okay, you've got to introduce birth control to help that population so they don't just overrun themselves with too many children that they can't take care of because of famine and lack of water and stuff like that. So we know that's important overseas, right? But why don't we understand that it's the same type of thing here on a different level?
Great question. That's a very great question. And somehow it seems like we can get our arms around problems in other countries because we don't have to then deal with them up close and personal. whereas once we have to really deal with them here, we have much more difficulty. I will tell you a theory that I have, and I believe it has to do with America's very ambivalent relationship with sex. We live in a culture unlike many of the cultures of other, particularly other developed countries and other countries in the still developing world, who have much healthier and more realistic attitudes about sex and human sexuality as a normal part of human existence. And they are less susceptible, therefore, to the minorities within their society who have very retrogressive views about sexuality. For example, it's not just sexist points of view that woman's place is very limited. She should be barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen. But also it tends to go along with homophobia and other kinds of very sexually repressive points of view. And racism is pretty well correlated with that as well. So, you know, I mean, we're a society that keeps trying to get better, and I think we can get better, but America is really going to have to come to grips with its very bifurcated attitudes about sexuality if we're ever going to solve some of these problems and quit arguing about things like contraception. And when I say bifurcated, I mean that American society uses sex to sell everything from toothpaste to cars to anything, you name it. But it's really very difficult to get straightforward, honest information and education about sex and sexuality, and to recognize that every human being is sexual in some way and needs to have appropriate information in order to be responsible about their lives.
Absolutely. And I've been watching with great interest and a little distressed, to say the least, that so many of the state legislatures are enacting some very bizarre laws right now, or trying to get them done, that you just wonder, my goodness, you were just waiting for the right convergence of time and weird people to come together. And, you know, I try to go backwards. I mean, completely backwards. And I know that the women are not going to put up with it. I know that, well, here's what I think. I believe that even, frankly, Republican women are going to go into the ballot box this year and they're going to say no. They're going to figure out how to say no. They don't have to tell their husbands. They're just going to do it because we just can't let this stand. You know, there's some things that just cannot be this way. Does that make sense?
I think you're right. And my current soapbox, the thing I am most annoyed by right now, and I just saw it happen again on the morning television shows this morning, when yet one more, I think it was Luke Russert this morning, who called talking about contraception a distraction, and women's health issues as being a distraction. And I think quite to the contrary. These issues, birth control, even abortion, sex education, these are just the tips of a much bigger ideological iceberg that really does have to do with worldviews, differing worldviews about women's place in society and about the nature and purpose of human sexuality. So I think what's happening is we're just seeing, you know, that Muriel Rukeyser poem, if one person ever told the truth, the world would split open?
Yes.
I think the world is splitting open, and I think you're seeing it, and you're seeing it on these issues about women's health and rights, but you're seeing it on a lot of other issues as well. And I agree with what you say about women at the ballot box in November. Even though November is a long way off, and we shouldn't take it for granted, we have to keep reminding them of it, because it is a long way from April to November, and people's political memories are pretty short. But the reason I think you're right is that it's sort of like the firestorm that kicked off with the Komen Foundation's defunding of Planned Parenthood. It was like suddenly women who had never been activists were touched in a personal way. You know, every woman I know, regardless of her political persuasion, has had a scare, or has had breast cancer, or knows a friend or a family member who's had breast cancer, and it's very personal and very scary. And so suddenly it touched them personally. I think the same thing is happening with the debate over contraception and women's health care, and it's that, whoa, wait a minute, now you're talking about me. You know, now this is not theoretical anymore. Now you're talking about me. And remember that a third of the electorate almost now is independents. So they're by and large socially pretty progressive even though they may be fiscally very conservative. So I think you're right about what's going to happen at the ballot box with Republican women and independent women and certainly Democratic women.
Well, it's interesting. You know, we're kind of talking about feminism in a way.
Oh, yeah.
I would like to define or redefine feminism, if I may. I believe men should be feminists, and I believe that all women should be feminists because all it means to me is that you are pro-woman. And somehow to think that, for example, someone like Pete, who has all women in his life pretty much, with the exception of a son-in-law, and frankly, that man should also be a feminist because he has two daughters. You see what I'm saying? And you should. I don't understand why the word feminism became such a negative word. You know, the movement, of course, threw men into a tizzy. But I think we need to redefine it. I think we need to say, no. Feminism is simply pro-woman. Why would you be anti-woman?
Right. No, to me, feminism is, I take it one small step further, and I think it is about social justice and about equality for both men and women. And it's like one of the things that I talk about in No Excuses, and one of the things that enables women to embrace their power, because what I found in my research and from talking with women all around the country and looking into my own life and my own journey, frankly, I have had my own issues with not being able to embrace my own power along the way too, is that we have in our minds an outdated version, or an outdated definition of power, that's the power over. In other words, somebody can make you do something. And I think that the people who have that, the negative definitions of feminism that you're talking about, have a definition in their mind of power as the power over, which implies that there's a finite pie. So what they're afraid of is that if women have power, have equality, that will take something away from them. But nothing could be further from the truth. Once I can get women to redefine power in our own minds as being the power to rather than the power over, we sort of shift from an oppressive, fearful sort of thing to an expansive, I can make life better for myself, my family, my kids, the world, my community. Well, then women say, oh, yes, I want that kind of power. And I think that women inherently get the fact that power isn't a finite pie. And in fact, the more there is, the more there is. And men, think about the terrible stereotypes that men have been locked into over the years, too. I'd be interested to hear what Pete has to say about this. But I think, you know, men have had to shoulder the entire burden of bringing home the paycheck. They've had to be the ones who asked women to dance, who asked women to get married, who had to take all the initiative. So men have been locked into very difficult stereotypes as well. And I think we've got to get past that. And that feminism really can liberate not just women, but also men.
I would agree. I fully appreciate what you're saying. There is certain burdens in being a man, different than burdens in being a woman, but there are burdens there because, as you said, you're expected to be the breadwinner. You're expected to bring home the bacon. So if you don't, you're looked at as less a man, less a success, and Lord knows we all need to be successful and all need to be climbing the ladder socially and economically. So that is some pressure. There's no doubt about it. You're absolutely right. I agree.
Well, I also would say that in an optimistic sort of way, that I think that young women have allies that those of us from the second wave feminism didn't have, and that is young men who have been raised by women like us. Mm-hmm. And younger men today, you know, when you talk about work-life balance and things like that, younger men today want to be more a part of their children's lives than our husbands and our fathers did. And I think that's great. I think that's fantastic. And I think that means that there will be a lot of changes in how the workplace is structured so that both men and women can have a life, particularly during those childbearing years, as well as making a living. And I think we'll see some new structures. I think that's going to be a very positive change.
Well, it's interesting. As you're saying that, I'm thinking back on the structure that is evolved to be my my daughter and son-in-law's family structure and with the two granddaughters. When I was younger and her mother and I, my daughter's mother and I divorced, my daughter stayed with me. And the fact remains that when we were together, I was doing many of the parenting deeds until Deborah came along that had to do with both mother and father, just like many women do nowadays that has to do with mother and father if the father's not there. The roles were somewhat reversed, but nonetheless, she saw that a man, her dad in this particular case, was doing this A, B, C, D, and E with regard to her life, with regard to decisions about her life, and so on and so forth. So when she went looking, I use this term loosely, but when she was in the market for a husband, for lack of a better way of saying it right now, she had certain criteria. And some of the criteria were she didn't want her husband to be certain things that her father was, but she wanted her father to be other things, her husband to be other things that he is. And one of them was caring, understanding, not domineering, works with you, works together, and she's got that man. She's got the man that is there. She goes and she works out at 5:30 in the morning. He's there getting the kids up and getting them ready for school. She comes home. She takes them to school. Then he gets himself ready and goes off to work. It is an absolutely fantastic teamwork situation. And she saw that. She saw that where she was raised. And I think more and more women and girls hopefully are seeing that as well as time goes on.
I do too, and I think we will see more of it. And in fact, it's interesting because even when you look at the more conservative right wing elements, they're now beginning to realize that that having women as being the upfront representatives, the spokesperson, is a great benefit to them. You recognize that. I mean, they too are recognizing that it's just electric to have women actively engage in all the different aspects of life. And so that too is changing the culture. I mean, it's really kind of amusing to me in some ways that I believe that we've changed the culture so much that even people who are theoretically, philosophically opposed to many of the progressive advances that I've worked for women over the last 40 years of my life, are putting women more out in the activist role or in the professional role because even they recognize that it's good. And by the way, one of the aspects of power that we women have in our hand that we are not always using to the maximum advantage is that all the studies from big consulting companies like Ernst & Young and McKinsey have found that those companies that have larger numbers of women in their upper management and in their boards of directors, on their boards of directors, those companies make more money. They have a better return on investment for their shareholders, and they make more money overall. So there's a great business case to be made. You don't have to just make the case as a it's a bleeding heart, like I've done most of my life, but not just because it's the right and true thing to do, but also because it's really becoming evident to everybody that it's better for society overall for women to have an equal place.
Right. Well, I want to say one thing about the power structure, for example, real quickly in Pete's daughter's relationship with her husband. She doesn't work, but she's got plenty of power in that household. And I think that's what maybe people don't realize, what power really means. I know you've got five definitions in your book that I found very interesting. Reward power and legitimate power, coercive power, expert power, and referent power. But what about personal power? And I think Carissa, my daughter, has personal power, and she knows how to use it, and it's a beautiful thing, and she's teaching it to her children. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that maybe the personal power is the pretty much akin to what the classic definition is of referent power, because that's influence.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be a formal place on an organizational chart, but it's charisma and influence and the ability to actually influence how things happen and to be, in my world of writing and speaking, it's what I call thought leadership. You know, it's ways of making your influence felt whether or not you hold a formal position. And I think actually, as my daughter reminded me multiple times when I was writing No Excuses, that mothers have the most power of anybody in our society. And that's certainly, there's certainly a lot of truth in that.
Yes. Well, let's talk about your book. First of all, I think you kind of alluded to mostly what inspired you to write the book. But have we left out anything as far as what made you write that book? Is there something else you'd like to tell us?
Yeah, sure. I'll tell you exactly the story of what prompted me to become as obsessed with the question of women in power as I did. And it is that in 2008, I was asked by Elle Magazine to write a story on women running for office. Now, if you can roll your tape back to 2008 in the early part of the summer, that was a point in time when it looked like we might actually have our first woman president. And at that, it
right
was
there.
So there we were. And so everybody was going on and on about how, oh, we were about to have another year of the woman like we had had in 1992, when suddenly there were, you know, the largest number of women ever were swept into Congress. Well, so I started interviewing the heads of the many organizations that now exist to help women run for office. Men don't have these organizations. But there are now dozens and dozens of organizations. There are organizations on the Republican side, organizations on the Democratic side. There are nonpartisan organizations like the Women's Campaign Forum the White House Project. There are there are dozens of them. So I interviewed the heads of most of the major ones of these organizations. And almost every one of them said exactly the same thing to me. It was like they were reading from a script. They all said, a man gets up in the morning, looks at himself in the mirror, and he decides, I'm going to run for Senate. He does not question whether he's capable. He does not question whether he knows what he needs to know to run for Senate. He just figures he's entitled to do it. And so he does it. A woman might have an interest in politics, but she'll say, well, first I need to learn a few things. Maybe I should take some courses. Maybe I should work in some campaigns and learn the ropes. And by the time she finally runs for office, the man already holds the office and is probably the committee chair setting the agenda. And so then I found out that women of all ages are something like 40% less likely during any time in their lives to even consider running for public office than men. And so what I realized was that even though women can now raise money as well as men to run for office, they are now trusted more by the voters, and they also, when they run, they are as likely to win as men. I mean, let's face it, you can't always assume you're going to win if you run. Many people run and don't win, but if a woman runs, she is statistically as likely as a man who's running to win the race. But why were women stuck at 17% of Congress, less than 25% of state legislatures, less than 10% of the mayorships of the largest cities in the country, and so on across the board? What was going on? I just felt like I had to figure this out, because had all my work that I'd been doing all my life to try to advance women been for naught? And then I realized that the dynamic was the same in the workplace, and actually in personal relationships as well, that across the board, women are stuck at something like 18% of the top leadership positions. Despite the fact that the doors are open, that we've seen a woman first almost everything, women are still at that level. And at that rate, it would take us 70 years to, at the rate we were advancing, it would take us at least another 70 years to reach parity. And since I couldn't live another 70 years as much as I'd like to, I decided that I had to do something about it. And that was really, it was really writing that article about women in politics, women running for office, or rather I should say not running for office, that caused me to become so fascinated with the topic of women's relationship with power, which I found really is a relationship. It's almost a spiritual thing. I mean, it's like a dance, and it is something that it is hard to change the culture while you're living in it, and that we just simply have to come to terms with if we have a vision for our daughters and our granddaughters to actually have the same opportunities that the boys do.
Well, I'm glad you're doing this work. I've done it myself in my own way you know, as a seroptimist. I'm not an active seroptimist right now, but I probably will rejoin pretty much because of our conversation today, because I realize that that's where I can do an awful lot of good the same way you are doing, you know, with a lot of people. And there are a lot of people that know me very well in seroptimist. And, again, my human rights status of women stuff that I did was actually epic. It's fun to know that you can do something and make a difference. And if, like Pete was saying when we started this, this is in my wheelhouse, it's because I care very deeply about women helping women. I care very deeply about women stepping up, stepping out, and just, you know, not saying, well, the man won't like it, or, you know, I don't want to rock the boat. No, I have to rock the boat. I have rocked many a boat in my time, in 58 years, and that's the only way sometimes that it can happen, you know, that somebody's got to be willing to rock the boat a little bit.
Absolutely. What's the biggest boat rocking that you've done?
I've actually helped a woman get elected to city council in Oceanside, California. Against all odds, I was her public information officer. Two elections got her elected. And the reason she decided to run, we were actually at a Seroptimist conference in Phoenix. At the time, I lived in California, obviously. And we were watching a woman speaking on stage, and the woman that I helped get elected, Colleen O'Hara, said to us, gosh, you know, every now and then I think about maybe I should run. And we all decided right then, yes, you not only shall run, you will win. And Seroptimist is a nonpartisan organization, but you can advocate for people voting. So we thought, okay, so we're not, you know, going to ruin our charter as a club by actually helping her get elected, but we had to do it in a nonpartisan way. But anyway, you know, there was some boat rocking because she had some things in her history that had to be handled. She was against the war in Vietnam, and this was in the city right next to Camp Pendleton. So, you know, it's like, that's a problem. That's a Marine Corps town, you know. So we had issues. But she's a fantastic woman, and she made a fantastic city council person.
That's a great story, and I'm sure it wasn't easy to get from the idea of running to the actual winning office, and there are many steps along the way. And so that is one of the reasons why, and I think, you know, what some of what you did is very illustrative of some of the power tools that I shared in No Excuses, because I think what you just described is that you took action, and I think that there are way too many studies and way too many books out there that tell women what's wrong with us and why we don't do these things. But what's important to me is to talk about how we can. And you did it. So that's great.
Yeah. And one of your first chapters is knowing your history. And I'm very intrigued by that. Again, just going back to the Seroptimist issue, and I want you to certainly talk about your book in terms of the history. But what I know is, just using women's suffrage as one of the elements, it took a man to cast the final vote to ratify that voting act. And we were talking about that with Pete, you know, that there still has to be a, you know, coming together of the mind, so to speak, between men and women to move women along. I mean, it cannot be just women taking their place and running roughshod over men. It has to be that dance, and it has to work. But it did take a young man who had a note in his pocket from his mother, and the vote was going to be that particular day, and the note said, "Son, I have been watching with great interest, and I know you will do the right thing, and you will vote for women's suffrage, you know, for the women's to get the vote," and he did. And I just think that's an amazing story. Don't you think that's
amazing? It is a great story, and there's so many aspects of it, and I'm so glad you pointed it out. Because the first comment that you made about the fact that's a great example of the men, of course, were holding the reins of the power of the vote to be able to enable women to vote. In other words, there were only men in those state legislatures that had to ratify the amendment to the 19th Amendment to the Constitution that would grant women the right to vote. So the women had to be able to persuade the men to vote for it. And that's another example of the power of motherhood, I would say, and the power of that influence power that's so critically important. And it's also a really great example of the power of one vote, because that was the in that state, was that Tennessee?
I think it was
Tennessee. Yeah. So this young man's vote was one vote. It was the one vote. I mean, that bill passed, or the ratification vote passed by his one vote in the state legislature. So the power of one is incredibly important. And when people say, well, I can't have any influence, you could talk about all this great stuff, but you know, you've been with big organizations and you could make a difference. But I'm telling you, the power of one is very, very big. And it one person in a democracy can make a big difference. So that's a great story on so many different levels.
Well, it's one of my favorites, and it just, like you say, it just has so many layers to it, because it works even today. You know, what is that one thing that can be the tipping point to change everything? For example, Lilly Ledbetter, and wasn't she at Discount Tire executive or something, and found out that all the work she'd been doing for 40 years had been great work, awesome. Glad you were with us, Lily. And then she found out that her pay was an amazingly short paycheck compared to the men doing the same work.
Yes.
And and for her to go ahead and step out and say, okay, that's really not okay. And I don't know if you've ever seen her on television, but she's a very unassuming, she's not a rabble rouser type person, but she just realized that it was she that had to do it. She's the one.
That's right. She saw the injustice, and I've had the privilege of actually meeting her, and she's exactly the same in person. And it was Goodyear, just to make sure we're crediting or blaming the right company
and not the other one. The wrong one. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. So it was Goodyear that she had worked for many years, and I think most people know that women earn about 77 cents to a man's dollar when after you have allowed for things like time off for childbearing and everything else. There's still over a 20% spread between what women are earning and what men are earning. And that was about the spread in Lilly Ledbetter's case, that she was doing the same job. She was doing the job. She had the time and grade. She had been with the company. She'd been a loyal employee. She'd had stellar evaluations over the years, and yet she was earning about 20% less than the men who had exactly the same time and grade and the same positions as she did. And so I think it was just incredible that she realized that it was not just about her, and that she used all the internal systems that she could to try to get justice for herself, and it didn't work out. And so then she took it to court. But that's what was really the great thing about Lilly, is she did realize early on that it wasn't just about her, and that by taking this lawsuit forward, that she was actually helping all women who would come after her. And I call that sister courage. I believe greatly in women helping other women and joining with other women. Men have always done this through the years. They've known how to network with purpose. They've helped each other out. They sponsor each other to get the next job. They bring their buddies into the company or into the system. And that's something that women need to practice and learn more systematically, and we need to apply that in our lives. And the sister courage thing that I teach about in No Excuses is it really has three parts. It's about how you can create a little movement, and use movement building principles in any endeavor that you want. And the first one is to reach out and be a sister. And if somebody needs help, you offer it. Ask for help if you need it. And I think Lilly Ledbetter really exemplified that reaching out part especially. And then she also realized that she needed to ask her sisters to help her. And she's gotten herself involved with many of the women's groups and got them organized. And that's how we got the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act passed. And that enables women now. I don't know if you – we didn't tell the whole story about what happened with Lilly, so let me just backtrack on that for a minute. She did win her lawsuits up to a point, and she won a very big award because of the discrimination she had suffered. But the Supreme Court reversed it and said that because she hadn't filed suit soon enough, that she had gone beyond the realm of the ability of her ability to sue the company, that there had been too much time between the time the discrimination happened and the time she filed suit. And so that she was not, so it was really a technicality. It wasn't that they said she wasn't entitled to it. It was that they said that she hadn't sued soon enough. Mm-hmm. So the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act now allows women to sue, or men if they feel that there has been discrimination against them that is gender-based, that now you can sue at any time that you discover it, even if it's 30 years later. So, but she then reached out. That legislation wouldn't have passed if she hadn't started reaching out to different organizations like the American Association of University Women and many other women's organizations, probably Soroptimist included, to get them engaged and involved in recognizing that action needed to be taken at a legislative level. And that was the first bill that President Obama signed, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, and it was symbolic that there was a recognition of the importance of paycheck fairness. But that legislation needs to go farther. There's another piece of legislation called the Paycheck Fairness Act. And that one would really be the real guarantee of equal pay between the genders. So there's still yet more work to do, but I just wanted to point out how Lilly Ledbetter had used Sister Courage to reach out. She reached out to her sisters. She asked her sisters for help when she needed it. She joined together with other people who saw that there was an injustice and something needed to be done about it. And then they took concerted action and they built a movement. And I think that's a very powerful, potent power tool. Things we can't do alone, we can do together.
Absolutely.
Gloria, what do you think that the women of the world, the women of this country, need to do to make up that 77%? I mean, what are there specific action points that you could point, that you could direct them to, say, do this, do that, and it'll help close that gap?
I think so. I actually think so. I'm pretty sure that we could close that gap within the next generation, if not sooner, by doing a few simple things. And those are the kinds of power tips and tools that I give in No Excuses. But what the research finds is that the reason why we are so far behind in our compensation, and frankly, over the course of our entire career, it costs us about $500,000 cumulatively. So listen up, women. This is worth paying attention to. It's because we don't negotiate our entry salaries as aggressively as men do, and we don't put ourselves forward as aggressively as men do for the next promotion, and we don't promote ourselves as much as men do. And those are all skills that can be learned. We can learn to negotiate. Negotiating skills are skills you can learn. And so I think it would be great if people learned in junior high and high school, you know, when they're taking these kinds of courses that they take about preparation for doing writing a resume or job applications and going through the interview process, they learn a lot about what clothes to wear, how to answer questions and things like that. But they really do need to learn very specific skills about how to negotiate. What women need more than anything else is not to have that moment of hesitation. The more I think about it, the more convinced I am of this. We got to, like, not have this moment of hesitation. If you think about it, when you are in a group, whether it's a business meeting, whether it's a public lecture, whether no matter what it is, if you're in a group with mixed men and women, and when it comes time, like if you're discussing an issue in a business meeting, who usually speaks up first? It's usually a man. If you're in a public discussion and it's time for questions and answers, who usually raises their hand first? It's usually a man. And I just think if women would learn nothing else but to learn that you have to define yourself. If you don't speak up, if you're not the first person to speak, then you risk having other people define you and define the issues. And included in that is this whole business of negotiating for salaries and so forth. I mean, if you don't ask for what you want and put your expectations out there first and let people know that you value or what value you bring to their company and their endeavor, how can you expect them to know that? You can't expect them to know that. You have to know your value. You have to advocate for yourself. Not have that moment of hesitation. Say the first word. say the last word, make sure you're defining yourself and your value to the organization. And I think that would just make a huge amount of difference to teach those skills from very early days.
I think you're absolutely right. And I was just thinking about how I might be the first person to speak, but I also might start off on the wrong foot by saying something like, well, I don't mean to interrupt, but, or, well, if I may be so bold, or, you know, it's
with disclaimers.
Almost apologetically. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, disclaimers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We do that.
Yes. And that is a feminine trait that I don't think is very positive.
not overly helpful. I mean, and here, to be positive about it, I think it comes from women having been taught to be nice,
right,
be considerate of others, to think of how what we say impacts somebody else. So, I mean, it would be good if young men were also socialized with those kinds of ideas.
Sometimes it's really just more diplomacy. You know, my father was a diplomat, so I believe some of that is cultural and diplomacy related, but some of it can also be a disclaimer as a woman. So I just think it's something that has to be discussed, and it is a skill that can be taught. I also want to say something about the equal pay issue. You know, Pete was mm-hmm. asking about how do we take care of that, and this is going to be kind of sarcastic in a way, but we could just really make more of a holiday out of Equal Pay Day. That comes around in April or May. And then we could just explain to the young girls that, you know, today is April 14th, and this is how long it took for us to make as much money for last year as the men made last year. And, you know, like, buy a flower for ourselves. And really, that's sarcastic, I know, but...
Oh, Deborah, I think that's a great idea. I think it's a wonderful... I think I'm going to be blogging about that. Give you all the credit.
Thank you. It is a great idea. Well, you know, it's shocking when you say, what? It took me till May 5th, you know, and then you start to say, oh, I see, I
mm-hmm.
see. This
right.
is what's not right, yeah.
Right.
So that would be something that that's a visual. Like, okay.
I love it.
Yeah, thank you. Well, that's sarcastic, but maybe necessary.
Well,
right,
but I think if I can just add, I mean, I think it's good. It's really helpful for people, first of all, to have a visual, but also – I don't think it's so much sarcastic as it's good to have a little sense of humor about things.
Yes.
And I think you can do that kind of thing with a sense of humor in a way that people will notice and take some action.
Right. Well, I loved one of your chapters that the last phrase in one of the sections was power unused is power useless. And it had to do with Flogher and the fact that there's this blogging community of women who could literally change the world, or certainly our world in America, with just a few well-placed comments and a few well-placed, and I say few as in millions, because there's that many people that could make this pull this off. And yet, when they go to convention, they're more like, you know, gathering up the stuff in the swag bag. And I just thought that was so perfect, because it is it's just a perfect way to visualize exactly what women are doing. You have all the power in your hands, and yet you're distracted by something else, like little shiny stuff to put in your bag. And why can't we just get our heads on straight?
We're just not used to having that kind of power, and it takes a level of proactivity that we're not accustomed to having. And so that's the point of talking about it, and why I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it with you here today, because really, very often, as I said before, it's hard to change a culture while you're living in it. They say the fish can't see the water they're swimming in. It's that same kind of thing. And sometimes to see what's wrong, or what we ourselves are buying into, how we have been co-opted, you have to almost be whacked up the side of the head to really see it. And that's what happened to me when I went to my first Blogher conference. The Blogher is a huge, massive portal that has about 25,000 women who blog on it and are in their advertising network, and it is read by something like 40 million people a year. So it's very large. It has massive readership. About 10% of their bloggers are male. They call them blog hymns. So I don't have any way of knowing whether the blog hims had the same problem as the blog hers. But the blog hers, what I found was that, what I learned at that point was that women buy 85% of the consumer goods that are sold. And yet we make up only maybe 15% of the boards of directors of the companies that decide what's going to be out on the marketplace. And what just hit me between the eyes was that, well, that if we have that much of the power of the purse, we could be shaping every consumer product that's out there. But instead, what I saw happening at this conference was that the marketers all knew the power of women's purses. And they were giving away these products like everything from cars to cameras to vacuum cleaners to laundry soap. I mean, you name it, it was there. They were just falling all over themselves to get women to try their products and to give their products away and to blog about them, because what they know is that women trust other women's recommendations for
right.
consumer goods, you know, more than they trust an advertisement. So, and then I would go into the meetings and the women would be wringing their hands and worrying about whether it was ethical for them to be endorsing products. And I think it's good that they were worried about that, but I just thought, my goodness, don't you realize that if instead of having that as your topic, if you got together and decided, what are our three priorities? Do we want our children to all have healthy snacks? Well, we could make all the food companies revise their, you know, what they're putting in those snack bags so that our kids are getting something that's healthier than food, than a Cheeto, you know?
We could,
and my personal mission is to get nice roomy pockets in women's clothes, because I'm so jealous of men's jackets that have these nice big pockets in them, so they don't have, that's why men don't have to carry handbags, and I would love that. We could change anything. I mean, just being not being facetious about it, we could change anything if we wanted, if women decided that all automobiles had to be more environmentally sound, we could make that happen in a nanosecond just by our purchasing habits, if we did it together collectively and made that point. So yeah, there's a phenomenon that is called co-opting. It's easy for us to make it happen. You want to be part of the culture, you want to be part of the society, but once you see that something could be really different because you have this incredible amount of potential power, but it's only potential and it's not power until you actually use it. So, yes, ma'am, indeed, just what you said, power unused is power useless.
I just love that. That's something I'm going to keep thinking about for a long time, I'll tell you. So the last thing I kind of want to talk about is, how do younger women and older women differ in their views on power and leadership based on not only your book but your class that you're teaching and the people you've talked to? I have a sense that it's probably – well, in my case, I feel like we almost need to redo the women's movement. You know, it's like, okay, somebody's got to start over here because we've gone backwards.
Yes, we've both gone forwards and backwards, and to some extent it's because we've been so successful that we are going backwards a bit now, just because, again, it's just hard to see while you're living in it what still needs to be changed. But it's a great question, and I think there are generational differences, but they're probably not as great as we would like them to be. Young women still don't want to go into politics. Young women still don't particularly aspire to the executive suite. And until they do in an intentional kind of way, those numbers that we talked about earlier on in the hour aren't going to really change that much. And so what I feel is that young women need to be socialized with more of the kind of intention that young men are socialized with, to the what it is that makes a young man look at himself in the mirror and say, I'm going to run for Senate. It's that intentionality, that recognizing that the world is your oyster, and you not only can, but you actually should go do whatever your personal gifts and ambitions and aspirations lead you to want to do. And so I think we as women have a lot of work to do. One of the power tools, the ninth of the nine power tools that I share with women in No Excuses, is tell your story. And this is, to me, just so so valuable in terms of the generational question that you asked. Because I found in talking with younger women that they were hungry, I mean really hungry, to hear the stories that older women could tell them. They want to know what was hard for us, not just the successes that we had. They want to know how we overcame problems, because they are now dealing with a lot of problems and issues that nobody prepared them for. They want to feel that they have a connection with older women, and that they too can, you know, they can learn from us, and they can share their concerns and aspirations with us. So, I mean, I just feel that whole business of telling your story. Your story is your power and your truth. And if we older women could just take a little time, sit down with younger women in our families or that we know in from work or social organizations or religious institutions or wherever, just take a little time and share our own personal stories with them, I'll tell you, it'd be so helpful, and they're really looking for it. Even if they don't ask you, they're looking for it.
Right. Well, I have to say, we have wonderful role models in the political realm. If you think about Margaret Thatcher, Golda Meir, Hillary Clinton, the new president of Brazil, I can think of some women that are amazing, not so many in America because of how parity has worked so far, but there are some women to look to that you see, okay, you know, they can run a whole country, and then there, but how many counterparts to Steve Jobs are there? feminine counterparts, right? How many?
Great question. I don't know of any. Do you?
No, I don't.
I don't know of any. And I think to me the next great leap for women, and I just started blogging for Forbes Women, and this was my first blog post that I did on Leap Day, and because it just, I started thinking about Leap Day and looking into the history of it, and I found it quite fascinating, and I agree with you. It seems like the next big leap for women is going to have to be a woman, or women preferably, who create a new technology that is so changes how we live, how we think, how we work. And in the doing of it, we'll also be amassing very substantial wealth. But I think that's important, but probably secondary to that big culture shift. That the female Steve Jobs, the female Mark Zuckerberg, you know, the founder of Facebook,
right.
That's what I think our next big leap is going to be. And I personally am very excited about it. I have a feeling we're going to see it in our lifetime. And it gives me goosebumps to think about it.
Well, I think we are too, and I'll tell you why. I'm 58 years old, and I know a lot about technology. I'm not going to create any new technology, but I use it like crazy. And I'm a Kindle publisher. I know how to do everything on the computer that any man knows how to do, including, you know, how to run a webinar and how to do a teleseminar and how to do a telesummit. I can do all of it. And I think that there just needs to be more women that are all ages that are stepping up and stepping out and saying, I know how to do that, and I'm going to do that, and I'm going to be famous for it. And I think that's part of it, is that women a lot of times will be really good at something, but they just will not blow their own horn.
Right,
you know?
Right.
They'll just be good and quietly good, you know, and I think it's time to start blowing our horns again.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. I almost want to buy horns for everybody to help them do it and give them a little rah-rah cheer.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And if I can, you know, as we start to wrap up this hour, I guess the thing that I want to say to any woman, young or old, who may be listening and thinking, oh, yeah, well, okay, that sounds really good, but it's just too hard, and I've tried and I can't do it, or I don't think I want to put that much effort into it. One of the things that I learned in the leadership of arguably one of the most challenging movements, organizations in the country, if not the world, is that what happens to you as you do things is you grow your courage muscles like you grow your physical muscles when you work out. And it gets to be very gratifying to realize that you can actually, even if it's incremental, you can make real difference in your world. And again, even if it's a small part of your world, even if you're not thinking about changing the entire structure of the workplace or something like that, it's amazing what you can do. And you do seriously grow your courage muscles. You get more proficient at whatever it is that you're doing just by doing it. And so that's sort of the word of encouragement and inspiration that I'd like to leave women with as they listen to this show today.
Well, I love that. And of course, the word courage is right in the word encourage. So kind of has, you know, it really does wrap it up. I mean, that's it. Encourage, go courage, you know, go for it.
Yep.
And your book is a must-read, absolutely.
Thank you.
So let Pete kind of wrap us up here and make sure that you get to tell about how people can get your book. And
sure.
Exactly that, Gloria. I want to thank you for being a guest. It has been probably one of the better hours that we've had in conversation on the Boomer the Babe Show, and it's all in part to what you are doing and who you are. So I thank you again for that. Tell us, please, how people can get hold of your book. Tell us anything.